Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
There is no more room for tolerance over participants in illegal rallies. And from now on, those who participate in illegal rallies will be confronted more harshly, and judiciary will confront them more decisively.
Iran's police chief warns opposition protesters to stay off the streets as tens of thousands of government supporters march in state-sponsored rallies. Hundreds of prominent activists have been arrested. We'll get the latest. Then immigrant advocates are trying to stop the deportation of a Haitian community leader here in New York. But first, as 2009 draws to a close, we'll put the year in perspective, from war to civil liberties to health care to the media. We'll speak with Salon.com blogger Glenn Greenwald. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A suicide bomber attacked a CIA base in Afghanistan Wednesday, killing 8 Americans. Most, if not all, of the dead were CIA employees or contractors. Several others were seriously wounded in the attack. The Washington Post described the suicide bombing as one of the deadliest attacks on the CIA in the agency's history. The CIA base was located in the eastern Afghan province of Khost, which borders North Waziristan, the Pakistani tribal area. It's unclear how the assailant gained access to the heavily guarded base. The Taliban, which claimed responsibility for the bombing, said one of its members, who was working for the Afghan army, carried out the attack. The CIA has been at the forefront of U.S. counterterrorism operations in South Asia, launching drone attacks in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The main CIA station in Afghanistan is based at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, but most of its staff work at secret bases and military outposts. In a separate incident in Afghanistan, 4 Canadian troops and a Canadian journalist were killed Wednesday. They died when their armored vehicle was hit by a roadside bomb in southern Kandahar province. The journalist was identified as 34-year-old Calgary Herald reporter Michelle Lang. She's on her first assignment in Afghanistan and had only been in the country since December 11th. She's the first Canadian journalist to die in the Afghan war and is believed to be the first Calgary Herald reporter ever killed on the job in the paper's 126-year history. This is Calgary Herald editor Lauren Motley.
She was the person that you could always look to be an example and to take things and make them special, because she was a special person. And we really feel for her family and her fiancé, and her friends, obviously, whether they're in the newsroom or elsewhere.
In other news from Afghanistan, Al Jazeera reports at least 8 Afghan civilians have been killed in an air raid by foreign forces in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. Meanwhile, protests were held in several Afghan cities Wednesday over reports that international forces killed 10 civilians, including many schoolboys, in an attack earlier in the week. NATO officials have denied civilians were killed, but Afghan investigators said nearly all those killed were school-age boys. In a statement released yesterday, President Hamid Karzai's office said a unit of international forces descended from a plane Sunday night in Ghazi Khan village and took 10 people from 3 homes. Karzai's office said all the people were detained and were shot in the head. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper has temporarily shut down Parliament until March, after the close of the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. The move shuts down all parliamentary committees, including a probe into whether Canadian troops turned over Afghan prisoners to Afghan authorities to be tortured. Liberal House Leader Ralph Goodale accused Harper of padlocking Parliament and shutting down democracy. Goodale said, quote, 3 times in 3 years and twice within 1 year, the Prime Minister takes this extraordinary step to muzzle Parliament. This time, it's a cover-up of what the Conservatives knew and when they knew it about torture in Afghanistan, he said. 4 Nigerian farmers have won the right to take oil giant Shell to court in The Hague. A Dutch court said on Wednesday it has jurisdiction to hear the case. The Nigerian farmers claim oil leaking out of a Shell pipeline polluted their farmlands and fish ponds. Geert Ritsema of the environmental organization Friends of the Earth welcomed the decision.
we think this is a breakthrough because it's now acknowledged by a Dutch court that the actions of Shell outside of the Netherlands can be, they can be held liable for these actions and they can be held responsible. And that is the most important victory of today.
The four Nigerian farmers who filed the suit against Shell are expected to testify soon about the oil company's presence in Nigeria. 86 international activists and journalists have reportedly entered Gaza carrying humanitarian aid, but the Egyptian government is continuing to block more than 1,200 other activists with the Gaza Freedom March from crossing the border. Organizers said Egypt's position has prevented more aid from entering Gaza. Meanwhile, in Cairo, plainclothes Egyptian police officers beat members of the Gaza Freedom March as they staged a demonstration to demand the right to enter Gaza. Protesters were reportedly beaten with blows to the head and forcefully kicked. Other activists were detained in hotels. One Belgian protester named Maud said Egyptian security forces were tightly controlling their actions in Cairo.
There is a lot of events in the street during the last few days, and now there is a big manifestation. But it's not possible for us to join our group because the police is making a circle, and we cannot turn in. It's not possible now.
In business news, the Treasury Department has announced a third bailout for GMAC, the financing arm of General Motors. The Treasury will inject $3.8 billion into the company, and the U.S. government will boost its stake in the firm to 56%. The money comes on top of $12.5 billion that the U.S. Treasury had previously invested in GMAC to keep it afloat as the lender of choice for car buyers and dealers at GM and Chrysler. In other business news, the city of Memphis, Tennessee, has filed a lawsuit against Wells Fargo for singling out black homeowners for high-interest subprime mortgages. The lawsuit alleges, quote, unlawful, irresponsible, unfair, deceptive, and discriminatory mortgage lending in Memphis and Shelby County. Similar lawsuits have already been filed against Wells Fargo by the city of Baltimore and the state of Illinois. A new British government report has found that rising temperatures in Kenya could put an extra 4 million people at risk of malaria. Climate change has already caused a sevenfold increase in cases of malaria on the slopes of Mount Kenya. The Guardian reports climate change has raised average temperatures in the central highlands region of Kenya, allowing the disease to creep into higher altitude areas where the population has little or no immunity. And the Federal Environmental Protection Agency said Wednesday it has major concerns about New York State's plan to allow hydraulic drilling for natural gas in upstate New York and the Marcellus Shale watershed. The EPA said it was particularly concerned about how the drilling will affect the regional water supply and air quality. The EPA's comments come 1 week after New York City environmental officials demanded the state reverse its decision to allow natural gas drilling upstate because chemical used in the drilling process could contaminate the city's water supply. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. As 2009 draws to a close, today we begin by taking a step back and putting this year in perspective. The war in Afghanistan was escalated twice in 2009 by President Obama, and with it, the death toll of Afghans and U.S. and NATO forces. In the latest news, a suicide bomber attacked a CIA base in Afghanistan Wednesday, killing 8 Americans. In Pakistan, the number of U.S. drone strikes has increased dramatically over the past year, and in Iraq, there are still tens of thousands of U.S. troops deployed. Now, a new military front appears to be opening up against Yemen, with Obama ordering cruise missile attacks there. Meanwhile, the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay remains open, and human rights groups have decried what they call an Obama administration policy of preventive detention. On the domestic front, the president's top legislative priority, health care reform, is lurching forward with legislation passing both the House and the Senate. But many question the nature of the reform with no public option and no employer mandate.
For analysis of 2009, we turn to Glenn Greenwald, a constitutional law attorney and political and legal blogger for Salon.com, joining us now on the telephone. Glenn, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk beginning in Afghanistan today. You've got—we know the U.S. contractors, CIA employees who were killed, 8 of them, 4 Canadian troops and the first Canadian journalist killed in Afghanistan, Michelle Lang, for the Calgary Herald. It's always much tougher to find out exactly how many Afghans have died. Talk about this war on this last day of 2009.
Well, I think in a lot of ways it's a very kind of morbid, though powerful, symbol of what it is that we're doing, which is we continue to, every time we are targeted with some sort of terrorist attack, we seem to respond by escalating. And there's this sense that the Obama administration is less bellicose and less committed to warmongering than the Bush administration was. And although that may be true on several levels, as Juan just suggested before I came on, we are escalating our military presence and our aggression in numerous parts of the world, Afghanistan being only one of those cases. And when we do that, not only can we expect that we are going to suffer the kinds of casualties that you just described, but we're going to be bringing the kinds of deaths not only to Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters, but also to civilians, as just happened as well, according to Afghan officials, exactly the kind of death to civilians and to Muslims that cause and exacerbate the very threat that we're purportedly trying to undermine. And so what we're doing is we're bringing this constant cycle where we bring death to their part of the world. They then try and bring more death to our part of the world, as we saw with the attempted terrorist attack on the Northwest jet. And we continue to respond by doing exactly that, which perpetuates the cycle. And I think the multiple horrible incidents over the past 24 hours in Afghanistan symbolizes what it is that we're doing.
And Glenn, what about the situation in Yemen? We have the situation of this Christmas Day attempted bombing, apparently coming out of Yemen, and yet the American people are not well aware of how deeply already the United States is involved in this new front in Yemen, in the fight against the so-called war on terror.
Well, first of all, I think that's the critical point, is that what this really is a covert war. The New York Times called it a covert front in the terror war, whatever you want to call it, a front in the ongoing war or a new war. The reality is that we're involved in a war in a new country that most Americans had never even thought about or heard of, let alone given thought to whether we should be involved in war there. And when you count the number of countries, of Muslim countries, where we're actively engaged in some kind of warfare, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and now Yemen, that's 5 different Muslim countries where we are either occupying, invading, or bombing, and that's to say nothing of the conflicts that our primary client state in the Middle East, Israel, has with a whole bunch of other Muslim countries and the other Muslim countries that we're threatening, such as Iran. So we are expanding the wars and aggression in the Muslim world. Yemen is a prime example. And specifically with regard to Yemen, if you talk to virtually any expert in that country, and I interviewed one at Princeton last week, across the political spectrum, what they will say is that when we shoot missiles into various sites in Yemen and kill civilians, as we did 8 days ago, and there's no question that, although there's some question about what exactly our involvement was because it's a covert war, there's no question we were involved heavily and enabled the attack. When we kill civilians or shoot missiles or drop Hellfire missiles into that country, and when we prop up the dictatorial oppressive regime that runs that country, we are unquestionably doing exactly that which al-Qaeda could wish for. We are helping al-Qaeda convert the population and bringing greater and greater sympathy to the cause of Islamic radicalism. And so here you saw a plot that quite likely had something to do with Yemen. And obviously there's a connection between what we are doing in Yemen in terms of our military assaults and interfering in their country and propping up an oppressive regime and the desire on the part of people of that country to attack us and the willingness on the part of the population, not just al-Qaeda, but the normal population, to be supportive of those efforts because they perceive that we are bringing death to their country and it's only fair that they return those actions.
And what does this mean, Glenn Greenwald, for Guantanamo prisoners from Yemen being returned there? What is it? The ones left at Guantanamo, about half of them are from Yemen?
Yes, about how there's roughly 200 prisoners currently at Guantanamo, and 90 of them are from Yemen, and that's been one of the primary obstacles, is that the government, the Obama administration, and before then the Bush administration, has not wanted to release any of the detainees to Yemen because they don't trust the Yemeni government to safeguard those detainees. There was, in 2003, a prison break in Yemen where the current leaders of al-Qaeda in Yemen escaped, and that's what really led to the revitalization of Yemen. The problem is that by holding 90 people from Yemen in Guantanamo without charges of any kind indefinitely, and many of whom are clearly innocent and have done nothing wrong, that too exacerbates the anti-American anger and hostility that fuels terrorism. It's a huge propaganda tool for al-Qaeda as well. And to their credit, the Obama administration actually just 2 weeks ago released six Yemeni detainees back to Yemen in an attempt to close Guantanamo, on the ground that keeping Guantanamo open is more threatening and more dangerous than releasing these detainees back to Guantanamo, and yet what you see is the normal bipartisan reaction. You saw people like Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman, but also Dianne Feinstein, immediately pipe up and demand that no more detainees be released to Yemen, even though these are people who are guilty of nothing, have never been charged with any crime, and against whom there's no evidence. And that's another perfect example of how the policies that we're pursuing in the name of fighting terrorism are fueling that very threat.
And, Glenn, another area where the Obama administration has expanded military activity, obviously, to Pakistan, in the border areas of Pakistan, yet Pakistan is continuing to witness almost daily attacks within its country by militants.
Well, this is, I think, very similar to what we just discussed in terms of what we're doing in the Muslim world generally, and specifically the counterproductive conduct that we're pursuing in Yemen. I mean, the myth from the beginning has been that there is a certain group of evil, intrinsically evil people called the terrorists, and the key to beating them is to just kill them all. And once you kill them all with bombs and other air attacks and the like, or if you lock them up forever, once you do that to the finite group known as the terrorists, there will be no more terrorists, and we will have won the war on terror. And that's why we've relied continuously and increasingly on acts of violence, with the idea that if we're just going to eradicate the terrorists. And, of course, what we actually have been doing over the last 9 years, and we don't ever learn our lesson, is we're actually expanding the pool of terrorists. We're increasing rapidly the number of people who are sympathetic to Islamic radicalism and who are so angry at us that they're not only willing to kill innocent civilians, but they're willing to give up their own lives to do it. And if you look at all kinds of sources, you can go back to a 2004 task force that Donald Rumsfeld appointed. You can look at what David Rode, the New York Times reporter who was kidnapped by the Taliban and held captive for 8 months, said. You can look at the British reporter Johan Hari, who interviewed ex-jihadists. All of this evidence proves that the more we engage in these kind of air attacks in Muslim areas, and that certainly includes in these tribal regions of Pakistan, the more civilians we kill, the more terrorists we create. And we've certainly, there almost certainly are far more terrorists now, people willing to do violence against us, than there were 9 years ago as a result of what we're doing. And this covert action in Pakistan, it too is a covert war. There's no congressional authorization for it. There's virtually no discussion of it by government officials. It's having the same effect as our bombing campaigns in Yemen.
Glenn Greenwald, talk about the media coverage of the wars. And also, you wrote an interesting piece about the New York Times coverage of Sami Al-Haj, the Al Jazeera reporter who was held at Guantanamo for about 6 years and then released without charge.
Well, this is what I find actually most interesting and the most significant aspect of all of this is it's generally assumed that there is a significant disparity between how we as Americans or Westerners perceive of all of these events and how the Muslim world perceives of these events. And that is true. There is a very grave disparity. But generally what we assume is that the reason there's this grave disparity is because we are rational and informed and educated and advanced and, most of all, free. And therefore, we know the truth about what's going on, whereas Muslims live live in a oppressive and primitive and backwards countries. They're consumed not by rationality but by religious fanaticism, and therefore they have very distorted and partial and propagandized views of the world, and that's what accounts for this disparity. Now, the reality is exactly the opposite, because all of the things that we were just discussing about the effects of our air strikes in all of these Muslim countries, the fact that we are constantly waging war in an increasing number of their nations, and the fact that we routinely slaughter innocent men, women, and children who are the victims of our airstrike, the Muslim people in the Muslim world in those countries are very well aware of what we do, because the images are reported constantly. They're informed about what we're doing. And yet, if you look at American media coverage, it's virtually never the case that the victims of our actions, of our airstrikes and our military assaults, are discussed. Those things are kept from us. And so they perceive that we are the aggressors because we are killing civilians, which we're doing. But Americans are propagandized. That information is basically kept away from their sight. And so they're unaware of what the actions are. And so when there's anger and hostility and hatred in the Muslim world towards the United States, they understand why. But we are confused and bewildered because the facts about why that is are generally kept from us. And you mentioned the story of Sami El-Haj, who was an Al Jazeera reporter, a cameraman, who was covering the invasion of Afghanistan by the United States in late 2001, when he was abducted by the United States and shipped to Guantanamo, where he was kept for 7 years, obviously without charges of any kind. He was interrogated almost exclusively, not about Osama bin Laden or about terrorism, but about the operations of Al Jazeera. He was clearly a prisoner because he was a journalist that worked for an outlet that the Bush administration perceived as being critical or hostile to its interests. So here was a journalist, a foreign journalist, that we imprisoned for 7 years. And if you go and research in Nexus or other media databases what the discussions were in the mainstream media about that incident, you can find almost nothing. So Americans were not informed that we as a government imprison journalists without charges. And there are lots of other foreign journalists who have been imprisoned the same way in Iraq and other places. And yet, when you have the case of, say, Rukhsana Sabari, the Iranian-American journalist who was imprisoned in Iran for 3 months, not for 7 years, but for 3 months, or the two journalists who were just imprisoned in North Korea,
just a few minutes, actually.
What you have is a media bonanza. And so it makes it gives the appearance that only foreign governments, but not our own, imprison journalists without charges. And this is what accounts for the disparity in perception. It's that we are being propagandized by our own media.
Do you think things have changed, Glenn Greenwald, from how the Obama administration is dealing with things after President Bush, or do you find them very similar?
Well, I think there are some changes around the margins. There's clearly an attempt to change the tone. There's been outreach efforts on the part of Obama to speak in a more respectful and less hostile and dictatorial and belligerent way to the Muslim world. You saw that in his speech in Cairo and other speeches that he's given. He sent a video to Iran that was designed to ratchet down the threatening and belligerent rhetoric earlier this year, and I think those things are important. And you would never have seen the Bush administration do that. I think there are other changes. If you look at how Obama reacted to this plot on the Northwest Airlines, the attempt to blow up the Northwest Airlines jet, he didn't try and turn it into something larger than it was or exploit it for political gain by running to the nearest microphone and engaging in all kinds of melodramatic pronouncements. He treated it as what it was, which was a failed attempt by criminals to kill people, and was much calmer and more sober about it. So I think those things have been beneficial on the margins. But I think that the fundamentals of our response to counterterrorism, which is, as I said earlier, that the solution resides in dispatching missiles and fighter jets and ground troops and invasions and soon-to-be sanctions in Iran as well, is doing nothing but escalating the very war that leads to terrorism in the first place. And I don't think that's changed very much at all, and certainly on the civil liberties front. Obama is every bit as committed to extreme secrecy, to detention without charges, to military commissions, the nuts and bolts of the Bush-Cheney approach, as the predecessor as well. So there are some changes in symbolism, some changes that are actually substantive, some improvements, but I think the fundamentals are clearly the same, and the results are the same as well, which are increasing attacks from that part of the world on the United States.
And there seems to be, doesn't there, a growing gap between the rhetoric of the administration and its actions. That from the early days, it appears, obviously, no one expected two escalations in Afghanistan in 1 year, as well as this expansion of the war on terror to these other countries.
Right.
Would you take care? I'm doing an interview in 2 minutes.
I think that the central attribute of the Obama administration, and it's ironic given that the campaign was all based on changing the nature of how Washington works, the central attribute of the Obama administration is to accommodate and keep in place the same power factions that have run Washington forever, and as a result, the same mindset, the same dynamic that governs Washington in virtually every area. And so, you know, I think that if you look at interviews that Obama has given, both before and after he was elected, there's clearly an awareness on his part of the things that we're discussing. I mean, he himself has talked about before how the more hatred in that part of the world we engender through our military strikes, the greater the threat is of terrorism. He's talked about before about how indefinite detention is a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda, and therefore we need to close Guantanamo. But despite that rhetoric, despite that recognition, the same policies are being continued. So we're closing Guantanamo at some point, but we're shifting the very indefinite detention scheme and military commission scheme that caused such controversy simply to a new location. And although he talks about how airstrikes inflame that part of the world, he's escalated airstrikes not just in Afghanistan, but in whole new countries as well, and in Pakistan especially. And so, you know, I think what you see is that he is afraid to or unwilling to challenge the orthodoxies of the intelligence community, of the Pentagon, of the lobbyists and industry interests that have long run Washington. And so whether his intentions are good, whether he has a pure heart, these things are impossible to know, but they're really irrelevant. The reality is that the same dynamic continues.
Finally, Glenn Greenwald, the issue of health care, your assessment of President Obama and what the Senate and the House are doing right now and his role in this.
Well, it's exactly what I just described, which is that the plan from the start was to meet in secret with the lobbyists and industry interests from the healthcare industry, the health insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and devise a plan that they were satisfied with. And the plan that they are satisfied with is one that promotes their interests. And so what we're going to have is an extremely immoral and destructive scheme where individuals are forced by penalty of law, enforced by the IRS, to turn over their income to the private insurance industry that has very few restrictions on what it can continue to do, so that people have to buy health insurance, whether they want it or not, whether they can afford it or not. It's a major boom to those industries. It'll ensure that that industry money stays with the Democratic Party. But I think that what it's done is it's bolstered and strengthened the private insurance industry that was supposedly the root of the problem in the first place, and that's classic Obama. Lots of nice rhetoric about health care coverage, some mild benefit to the poor, but a bolster and strengthening of the very system that he vowed to change.
Glenn Greenwald, we want to thank you very much for being with us, constitutional law attorney and legal blogger for Salon.com. His most recent book, Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Big Myths of Republican Politics. As we move out of this new term that I have learned, the naughties, right, from 0 to 10, and this blue moon tonight, once in a blue moon, and it's happening tonight on New Year's, the second full moon in a year. It hasn't happened for 20 years and will happen again in 29 years. Happy New Year, Glenn.
We go now to Iran, where tens of thousands of government supporters turned out Wednesday for state-sponsored rallies in cities across the country. Some demonstrators chanted, "Rioter hypocrites must be executed," and "Death to Mousavi," referring to opposition leader Mir Hussein Mousavi. Iran's police chief warned anti-government protesters to stay off the streets and threatened, quote, "the era of tolerance is over. Anyone attending such rallies will be crushed." Hundreds of prominent activists have been arrested since Sunday's mass street protests, including the sister of Nobel Peace Laureate Shireen Ebadi. Opposition websites say at least 1,500 have been arrested, but Iranian authorities put the number closer to 500.
In a minute, we're going to be talking about what's happening in Iran, but first we'll go to break. And then we'll look at the case in this last day of 2009 of a Haitian community activist here in New York who's about to be deported. We'll speak with the minister of the Riverside Church, who is advocating for him to stay, as well as his wife, who's at home here in New York with their three children. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we look at what's happening today in Iran, the number of people who are killed Sunday is in dispute, with opposition websites claiming 37 dead, the Iranian government acknowledging 8 deaths. Among those killed was opposition leader Mousavi's 35-year-old nephew, Ali Mousavi, who was buried on Wednesday. Meanwhile, The Washington Post reporting the Obama administration's preparing targeted sanctions against discrete elements of the Iranian government, including those involved in the deadly crackdown on Iranian protesters. For more on the unrest in Iran, we're joined now by two guests here in New York. Ervand Abrahamian is with us, a CUNY Distinguished Professor of History at Baruch College, author of a number of books on Iran, his most recent, A History of Modern Iran. Mazyar Bahari is with us as well, an Iranian-Canadian journalist, filmmaker and Newsweek reporter. He was arrested while covering the unrest that followed the disputed presidential elections in June and imprisoned in Tehran for 4 months. He was released in October and joins us now on the phone from London. Let us begin with you. As you come out of jail, released in October, can you talk about what is your understanding, Mazyar Bahari, of what is happening right now in the streets of Iran and in the prisons there?
Well, I think the first thing that I noticed when I came out of prison was that Iran was not a clerical state anymore. Iran moving towards the military dictatorship. The Revolutionary Guards, who are in charge of, who want to become in charge of Iran at the moment, they have taken over all strategic positions in the country, including the nuclear program, and they want to establish a military dictatorship in Iran. I think they will fail in the long run, but in the process of creating this military dictatorship, there will be much violence, bloodshed, and there will be many victims. What we witnessed a few days ago in Tehran and other cities is just the beginning of the end of the Islamic Republic as we know it, or even maybe as the government wants.
And what do you make of the government's efforts to mobilize its supporters and bring them out into the streets, as it has now attempted to do?
Well, I think the Iranian government, both before the revolution and after the revolution, whenever they lost their legitimacy, their popular legitimacy, they resorted to gather paid supporters. When you look at newspapers before the revolution, you can see that even 3 months before the Iranian revolution, there were many gatherings in support of the Shah. And people were, there were reports of, they were calling the revolutionaries the rioters and the agents of the black imperialism. And right now it's the same thing happening, that the government, from my sources in Iran, I was to some people in Iran yesterday and today, and they said that there were many buses of people from different cities around Iran came to Tehran in order to have this gathering of the government supporters. They shut down all government offices. The Tehran metro was free yesterday for the demonstrators. So the government really tried hard to show that it's still a legitimate popular government, which is not anymore. And one of the reasons is that the government don't think that this government is not even a religious government anymore.
Maziar Bahari, can you describe what happened to you? You wrote a piece in Newsweek called 118 Days, 12 Hours, 54 Minutes. Explain how you were picked up and what happened to you in the Evin prison.
Basically, what happened was that I was reporting for Newsweek magazine, and I did a film for the BBC and also for Channel 4 News here in the UK. And one morning, the Revolutionary Guards came and they picked me up from my mother's house. They took me to prison. I was charged with espionage. And I went through three different phases of imprisonment. In the beginning, they charged me with masterminding the Western media in Iran, and then they charged me with espionage. And at the end, they told me that you are a media spy, and that. And when I asked them, what is a media spy, my interrogator said that we still don't have a definition for it, but let's work on it together. And in that period of 118 days and 12 hours and 54 minutes, I was beaten repeatedly. I was physically tortured. I was psychologically tortured. And it's a very painful memory that I really don't like to elaborate on this at the moment.
How did you get out?
There was an international campaign for my release, as you may have witnessed in New York. Different media colleagues, especially people in Newsweek magazine and Washington Post Company, campaigned for me. They used all their resources, both in the media and in the diplomatic circles all around the world, to get people in the UK, my wife, Paula, she was the heart of the campaign. And I think the rational elements within the Iranian government finally told the Revolutionary Guards that this is more of a liability than an asset for us in prison. So let's get him out of jail as soon as possible.
I'd like to bring Professor Ervan Abrahamian into the conversation. Your sense of how the Obama administration has been dealing with these protests, the democracy protests in Iran now?
Well, I think they started off on a good footing. They wanted to distance themselves, really, from the problems in Iran and focus on the nuclear issue. Unfortunately, as time has gone on, they've got more and more involved in the internal issues in Iran, which doesn't help the reform movement in the country, because it immediately gets associated with the past, with British-American involvement. So although it's very tempting, I think, in Washington to speak out in favor of human rights, it doesn't really have the right effect in Iran. It would be better, in fact, to leave human rights issues to human rights organizations and really focus on Iran-U.S. relations, especially on the nuclear issue.
What do you think it's most important for people around the world to understand what's happening right now in Iran and how this fits into the history of resistance in Iran?
Well, the form it's taking is a long tradition in Iran that when there is opposition, the main way is to resort to the streets. It's as American as apple pie. I mean, protests, crowding, it's been since 1890s, this has been the main way. But one thing to remember is these protests only succeed when they're accompanied by strikes, general strikes, bazaar strikes, oil strikes, nationwide strikes. And that's what brought down the Shah's regime. So far, the demonstrations have not grown into strikes. So it's, I think, premature to see the regime as it is on its last legs. Until we actually see strikes, we have to be careful about writing an obituary of the regime.
And is that because the Iranian government still maintains firm control over the labor movement in the country, or are you—is there a strong labor movement within the country?
Well, I think the state itself is very powerful. The ministries, it also controls, of course, the oil revenue. It controls the means of violence. It has a patronage system. All these things don't win it friends, but it can actually, in a way, forestall strong opposition. And I would say there is also some support for the regime. We shouldn't minimize that. There is in the Iranian public, I would say about 25-30% of the population is evangelical, not very different from the U.S. Public. And the evangelicals would be looking at Ahmadinejad as a person who expresses their sort of both a working lower class and also religious sentiments.
I wanted to get—
If I may jump in here.
Yes, go ahead, Mazyar Bahari.
I would like to make three comments about Professor Abrahamian's comments. One thing is that I disagree with Professor Abrahamian about President Obama's stance on human rights in Iran. I think it was the right thing to do for the president to talk about human rights in Iran, because many Iranian people, they thought that there is a secret deal going on in the Obama administration and the Iranian government on the nuclear issue, whereby American government is going to be quiet about human rights abuses in Iran, and then the Iranian government will make some sort of compromise on the nuclear issue. And in Iran, as you know, the and the perception of reality is sometimes much more important than the reality itself. And as Professor Abrahamian rightly said, Iranians have a very bad memory of Western intervention in Iran, especially the American intervention in 1953 coup. And they thought that the silence of the United States is a continuation of that intervention and not President's words. But I think what the president should do now is to talk about the violence against the Iranian regime and condemn the violence against the Iranian regime as much as the violence by the Iranian regime. The danger right now in Iran is that many young people in Iran, as you know, there are Iran is one of the younger has one of the youngest populations in the world. They are being attracted to violent groups, violent separatist groups, violent terrorist groups, who basically had nothing to say before the June elections and even before Ahmadinejad's election in 2005. And many prominent reformists in Iran, they are really afraid of the violence on the street by the anti-government demonstrators. And I think the president really should condemn that kind of violence against the Iranian regime. The other point that I totally agree with Mr. Abrahamian is that the demonstrations in Iran will not succeed unless the farmers and workers join the students and the middle classes who have come to the street. At the moment, we don't see that much economic demand. The economic situation is getting worse because of Ahmadinejad Khamenei's
mismanagements of Iranian economy, but they still have some money. They still have access to resources, and there are not economic demands raised on the streets of Iran. But I think in a few years' time, even maybe earlier than that, we will see farmers and workers joining the demonstrators, and then I think the regime will be getting really worried, and then I think we can start writing the obituary of the regime.
Professor Abrahamian, what about that? What about the issue of the reform movement spawning violence of its own against the government, and whether that is a positive or a negative development?
I agree very much with Maziar. It's a very negative act. In fact, I would say they're probably agents provocateurs from the regime that are trying to incite violence, because that way, then, of course, they can come in and use much more violence on the protesters. The reform movement from the very beginning has been very insistent that it's a peaceful movement. It does not want violence. But the fact is, it's hard to tell how much it's emotion. People get angry, especially if they've been put in jail, tortured, and so on, come out, they get angry. Or how much it's then even outside organizations that come in and try to trigger off violence. So in some ways, I agree, it would be very good for a president here to make it clear that he's against all forms of violence, including people from the opposition using violence on the authorities.
Professor Abrahamian, you're for or against sanctions?
Well, I would, in theory, sanctions could be good if they're used as a last resort. I don't think we're there yet for the last resort. What has happened with the nuclear issue is, I think, the Obama administration put on the table fairly reasonable offers. At first, the Iranian government accepted it. Then they put a lot of qualifications in. And those qualifications are now being taken as a rejection. And therefore, there's more of a hastening towards sanctions, which is, I think, is a mistake. What I think the administration should be doing is exploring the qualifications and even bringing in other issues, broader issues about Iran's role in the Gulf, rather than rushing towards sanctions. And what's really, I think, dangerous now, is that the focus in Washington is sanctions itself, without thinking what beyond that. If that becomes the goal itself, it's basically a slippery slope.
Maziar Bahari, your view of sanctions?
Well, I think that the sanctions should be smart sanctions, which they are targeted towards the government and especially the Revolutionary Guard. Finances and banking transactions outside of Iran. Right now, the Revolutionary Guards, they've started to invest money in different countries around the world. We know of their investments in Malaysia, in China, in United Arab Emirates, and Russia. I think the American government and the Europeans, they should work with other countries in order to curb those kind of financial transactions. And I think there should be sanctions against buying nuclear technology and whatever is related to nuclear technology to Iran. But I think the president should really stop the sanctions that can hurt Iranian people. What is important to note in Iran is that we need the Iranian middle classes to be rather well off in order to continue this movement. Because when the middle classes are becoming poorer, this movement that we are witnessing in Iran, it may subside, and it may go towards the violence, and it may lose its leadership. So I think the sanctions, as Professor Abrahamian said, should be the sanctions that can hurt the country, that it can be the last resort. And in the meantime, they really have to focus on the banking and financial transactions and the nuclear program. Because the worst thing that can happen to Iran is the day when they reach the nuclear technology that they can build a bomb. I don't mean that the day they will get the bomb, they will go and bomb Israel, for example. No, that's not going to happen. But what will happen is that the nuclear bomb will bolster the confidence of the regime, and especially the guards, and they will put more pressure on the people inside the country as a result of that conflict.
Maher Bahari, we're going to leave it there. We want to thank you for being with us. Iranian-Canadian Newsweek reporter held for 4 months covering the protests after the elections in June. Ervand Abrahamian, CUNY Distinguished Professor of History here in New York at Baruch College. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Stay tuned tomorrow for our year in review, Hope, War and Resistance, as we go through the year of 2009. We'll be back in a minute.
Muchas cosas muy tristes pasan a diario en la frontera de México y Estados Unidos. La raza que va en busca del sueño americano.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, we end today with a story of a Haitian immigrant to this country who could be deported this week. Jean Montreval came to the United States legally in 1986. He's married to an American citizen and is the father of four U.S. citizen children. Montreval is a longtime community leader in New York City and active in a number of immigrant rights groups, including Families for Freedom, the New York City New Sanctuary Movement, and Detention Watch Network. On Wednesday morning, he was attending a regular immigration check-in when he was detained by agents of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE. He now faces deportation to Haiti for a 20-year-old drug conviction, for which he has already served 11 years in prison. He has not broken any laws since then. We contacted ICE for comment, but they did not respond to our query for the reasons for Montreval's detention.
For more on the case, we're joined now by two guests. Here in our New York studio, Joshua Bar-David is with us. He's Jean Montreval's attorney. And we're joined on the phone by Jeannette Montreval, Jean Montreval's wife. She's at home with their children. Let's start with you. Explain his case. Why now, and what were the charges against him years ago?
Well, the why now is a question that we haven't been able to answer. Excuse me. The charges against him years ago were for a drug conviction that occurred when he was a teenager, shortly after arriving in the United States. He essentially made some bad decisions, got involved with the wrong crowd. His father had passed away, and I guess he made a big mistake, for which he served time in jail.
11 years.
11 years in jail. As a result of that conviction, he was placed into deportation proceedings. At the time he was placed in deportation proceedings, he was eligible for an application. Unfortunately, by the time his case was adjudicated, the law had changed and he was no longer eligible. So while the appeals courts expressed concern that he was prejudiced by this change in law, he was never able to actually have his case fully adjudicated. He was ordered deported. Unfortunately, the Haitian government was not accepting deportees at the time, and he was released and able to resume his life. During that time, he proved himself to be an incredible member of our community. He married a U.S. citizen, has four U.S. citizen children. He's a loving father, a loving husband. He became very involved in his church, the Justin Memorial Church, active in numerous causes, numerous charities. He was also regularly checking in with ICE. He didn't try to go into hiding. He didn't try to do anything. He continued to make his presence known to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And for reasons that are unknown, they decided yesterday to detain him and apparently intend on deporting him within the next 72 hours to 1 week.
What kind of appeals process is left to him?
Unfortunately, it doesn't look like there is any legal appeals processes available to him. In 1996, the immigration laws were reformed by Congress, and they cut off—
And signed by President Clinton.
Signed by President Clinton. And the laws became extremely harsh, and they cut off numerous appeals, and they also cut off discretion for immigration judges to consider things like the impact on U.S. citizen children. Right now, there's a bill pending in Congress, the Child Citizen Protection Act, which would, for the first time since 1996, give immigration judges the authority to consider the impact that the deportation would have versus the nature of the reason a person is deportable, in this case, because of the criminal offense.
Janae Montreval, you're home with the kids right now. Your children are American citizens?
Yeah.
Are you an American citizen?
Yeah.
And when did you learn that your husband would be deported? What does this mean to you? Where is he now?
I don't know where he is. I've been calling all over, and nobody has any information. So, I don't know. He filed for deferral action, which basically was asking immigration to defer his deportation. They never responded. They just detained him yesterday.
And what does this mean for you and your children?
I'm going to be a single mother, and I was laid off from working for the Department of Education about 2 years ago collecting unemployment, and my unemployment has 2 more weeks left of payment. And it's going to be very hard because his income is not going to be here anymore.
And what kind of work was your husband involved in before he was seized?
We have a 15-passenger transportation business where he basically transport people back and forth to the airport, to daycares and stuff of that nature.
Joshua Bar-David, what could be done at this point? Now, if he has completely served his 11 years, and that was, what, 10 years ago?
That was more than 10 years ago, yes.
More than 10 years ago. Is it the intervention of politicians, of people? How does ICE respond?
Well, ICE does have the discretion to grant what's called deferred action. And essentially, it's a determination that their resources are limited and that they should not be spending their valuable resources on deporting an individual who has proven himself to be an important member of our community. As Janae said, she has 4 children. Jean Montreval had started a business, was paying his taxes, contributing in numerous ways. To now remove him from his family, to remove him from his community, has done a detriment not only to him and to his family, but to us as a society. We have to ask ourselves, what is better, to take a father away from his family when that father has proven himself to be a caring father, a caring husband, a contributing member of our society, or to allow him to remain? And the last hope is that Immigration and Customs Enforcement will consider this deferred action through community pressure, through political intervention. They will make a declaration within the next 72 hours that their resources shouldn't be spent on removing this individual from the United States and taking him away from all of us.
How many members of Congress or the senators here in New York intervene? Because it's my experience in these cases that when a congressman or a senator gets directly involved, that there's a greater likelihood of ICE using discretion.
There are members of Congress who are intervening as we speak and doing what they can to assist. Whether that's going to bear fruit, we're not sure.
Joshua Bar-David, I want to thank you for being with us. And Janae Montreval, best to you. We will continue to follow this case. But that does it for today's show. Happy birthday to Chuck Skurich. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokodusa, Armate, Angeli Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Nick Gillick, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, John Gerbuk, Vesta Godars. Tomorrow, our special Year in Review, Hope, War, and Resistance. Tune in for that and tell your friends. Have a very happy new year. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for this show that's Once in a Blue Moon. Happy New Year.